America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Turkey's highest court today, this is reported by the Associated Press, halted a parliamentary vote yesterday that looked certain to lead to a president rooted in political Islam. A victory for secularists who fear that that country, Turkey, is moving toward Islamic rule. The goal would be to elect a government with a fresh mandate and resolve a crisis that has seen the stock market plummet and the pro-secular military threaten to intervene. More than 700,000 pro-secular Turks demonstrated in Istanbul on Sunday, many of them women who believe that Islam ruling the state, political Islam, would deprive them of personal freedom and economic opportunities. Turkey's stock market continues its slide in reaction to the upheaval, dropping 3.2% ahead of the court decision in the evening. The index had sunk 6.3% as of Monday. Should governments be ruled by religion? Bruce Ledowitz believes so. He has a new book out called American's Religious Democracy, or American Religious Democracy, Coming to Terms with the End of Secular Politics. He's a professor at, how do you pronounce this, the university name, Bruce?
Duquesne.
Duquesne, thank you so much. The Catholic University Law School there in Pittsburgh, as I recall.
That's right.
Right. And welcome to our program.
Tom, thank you very much for having me on.
You, in your book, present is there a word that would be the similar words of secularization, religiousization? what's the word?
That's the word. You know, your example of Turkey is such a perfect example, because what Turkey shows and what was earlier shown in Algeria is that if people want to have a certain degree of religion in public life, you can't have secularism and also have democracy, which is why I call my book American Religious Democracy. Essentially, here in the United States, the people, by their votes, have overturned the wall of separation between church and state, and we're moving into a new era. It won't be an era in which a church controls public life. It'll be an era of democracy, but it is not, it won't be the same. It's true. The dream of really secular politics, I think, in the United States is over.
This is absolutely driving a stake into the heart of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and the framers and founders of the framers of the Constitution. James Madison, his first veto when he, the fourth president of the United States, his very first veto was vetoing money that was being given to a church in Washington, D.C. to care for the poor. And in his veto statement, he talked about how vital it was to prevent church and state from commingling. His concern, of course, James Madison is a Christian. His concern was that if the state started giving money to churches, that it would contaminate the churches. Jefferson's concern was that if religious folks got into power in Washington, D.C., it would contaminate government. It looks like they were both right.
That I can understand that you feel that way, but you have to understand.
Well, I don't feel that way. The founders felt that way.
I know, but you sound a little bit, Tom, in this particular instance, like Justice Scalia of the Supreme Court. The Constitution comes to mean fundamentally what the American people's commitments are. Now, I don't think that the framers wanted a strict separation of church and state.
And why did they put in two different places in the Constitution, specifically saying there shall be no religious test for public office on the one hand?
Absolutely.
Built into Article 1, as I recall, and then in the First Amendment that there shall be no official state religion.
It seems pretty clear
what their intents were.
You cannot have an official state religion. That's absolutely right. But it isn't clear at all. You remember Jefferson's famous phrase in the Jefferson Memorial, I fear for my country when I think that God is just and his justice will not sleep forever, when he's talking about slavery. Jefferson did not mean a separation of religion from public policy. That would have been impossible for all the framers, because they all thought history had a moral shape. They wanted a certain institutional separation between church and state, and that's perfectly reasonable. We're not going to have an American rabbi or an American minister. But on the other hand, they never thought of secular politics. I don't even think they knew what secular politics as such would be like.
From the Jefferson Memorial, for example, one of the quotes, the quotes that goes along with that is his quote where he says, I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man.
Right.
you're of the opinion that this was Jefferson stating that he thought that God should play some role in public life.
No, not that God should. It's not a matter of should. It's, he thought that God did. I mean, you know, you can't, if you think history has a certain moral shape, there's no point in pretending. If you think that we're replaying the book of Exodus, as he thought, in terms of slavery, there's no point in saying, well, God can't have anything to do with it. You know, it would have been pretty funny if one of the Egyptian ministers had gone to the Pharaoh and said, these Israelite slaves, they want to mix church and state. And slavery is a secular matter. But,
well,
this is a secular matter.
We're not Israel here. Let me just give you that quote in context then,
right.
Bruce Ledovitz. This was a letter that he wrote to Benjamin Rush, who was a dear friend of his. He was a deist. It was during the election of 1800. It was 2 months before he was elected president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
It was a private letter. In fact, he opens the letter by asking Rush not to make its contents public, at least until after the election. He said, "Dear sir, I promised you a letter on Christianity, which I have not forgotten." He said, "I do not know that it would reconcile the genus irritable vatum, the angry priests, who are all in arms against me. Their hostility is on too interesting a ground to be softened." Now, I'm reading this verbatim without any deletion.
No, right, I know.
The delusion on the clause of the Constitution, he's talking about the First Amendment, the delusion on the clause of the Constitution, which while it secured the freedom of the press, covered also the freedom of religion, has given to the clergy a very favorite hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity throughout the United States. And as every sect believed its own form, the true one, everyone perhaps hoped for his own, but especially the Episcopalians and Congregationalists. The returning good sense of our country, now this, in this context, he's speaking of his own election. The returning good sense of our, I think he is. Good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes, and the preachers believe that any portion of power confided to me, such as being elected president, will be exerted in opposition to their schemes. And they believe rightly, for I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me, but enough, too, in their opinion.
That's right. But, of course, he wasn't talking about taking away the votes from religious people to vote their way. He was talking about fighting the matter out democratically.
No, what he was saying is that religion is going to play no part in a secular government.
But
he was clearly a secularist.
Tom, you wouldn't want to go back to the 1870s and say that women are not protected by equal protection. You really
that has nothing to do with the argument about whether. If we have a Christian government in the United States, we may well do that because St. Paul said that women should not be participating. When they come into church, they should cover their heads and they should remain silent.
But the way the Constitution is interpreted is in accordance with the will of the people, fundamentally. It changes with the culture. And the American people have rejected this strict separation. And if you insist that the Democratic Party candidates try to take under God out of the Pledge of Allegiance, that would be the only way the Republicans could win the next presidential election.
Under I agree with you. And under God in the Pledge of Allegiance is largely symbolic. We're talking about laws being made that are rooted in religion.
The people who want it. It's symbolic to you, maybe, but the people who want it really mean it, and they have a right to mean it. You can't give it to a court to decide what the fundamental tone is of the public square. It's not a question of individual rights. It's a question of the right of a people to decide
the kind
of country they want to have.
So, Bruce Ledovitz, you believe that if the majority of the people in this country think that we should have essentially a theocracy, we should be making laws based on a religion, what happens when or if the majority of the people in this country decide that the religion that they're going to embrace is not your Catholicism or my Protestant Christianity, but is instead Islam, for example, or is instead Wicca? Would you go along with that?
Of course. Fundamentally, the answer has to be yes, because we do have a democracy. See, that's the problem.
That's where the founders said no, never. The founders and framers of the Constitution, the founders of this country and framers of the Constitution said, no, religion shall never contaminate the state.
It's impossible. For example, take stem cell research. Now, nobody could claim that there's a constitutional right to have that funded with tax money. So if religious people don't approve of it because for religious reasons, why shouldn't they vote to have their values made into public policy? And if
but
you
the majority
don't, if you
of people are in favor
them,
of stem cell research being funded by the federal government. The majority of Americans are in favor of the federal
That's
government
right.
funding
and so
stem cell research.
The majority of Americans will vote against that religious view, and we won't have.
It's not a religious view. It's a scientific view.
But
You've got a small minority who view it as a religious issue.
Regardless, though, you can't very well say they don't have a right to vote their values. There were a lot of religious people who favored civil rights. There were a lot of religious people who were against the death penalty. Do they not get a right to have their opinions count because they're religious?
Of course they do. That's not the fundamental disagreement that I think. Well, in any case, people can check out your book and make their own decision. American Religious Democracy. Coming to terms with the end of secular politics, Bruce Ledowitz. Bruce, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Good conversation. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
66-303-2270. Why he's so resolute.
God wished him to be our leader.
The court just couldn't but follow suit.
Now many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down.
When the day of choice arrives, victory shall be his again that day. So sing. My vote will not be needed. I'll just stay at home and pray.
Well, there's a plan. If your vote isn't needed because God ordained that George should be president, just stay at home and pray. February 26th, 1811, James Madison vetoed his first veto. A bill passed by Congress authorizing government payments to a church in Washington, D.C. to help the payment. He said, and I quote from his veto message, this would establish a legal agency, a legal precedent. He said, because the bill vests and said incorporated church and also authority to provide for the support for the poor and the education of the poor children of the same, it would be a precedent for giving to religious societies. As such, a legal agency in carrying into effect a public and civil duty. This, said Madison, cannot be allowed. It would establish a precedent for giving to religious societies a legal agency for carrying into effect a public and civil duty. This was simply to give money to a church to feed people. He vetoed the bill. He said you create a nonprofit secular organization or let the government feed them directly, but it should not go through a church. Thomas Jefferson rebutting the argument that America is based on Christianity, for example. June 5th, 1824, he says, our revolution commenced on more favorable ground than biblical law. It presented us on an album on which we were free to write what we pleased. We had no occasion to search into musty records, to hunt up royal parchments, or to investigate the laws and institutions of a semi-barbarous ancestry. We appeal to those of nature. Jefferson, one of the early Wiccans, I would say, we appeal to those of nature and found them engraved on our hearts. Ah, but some of the folks said, Isn't America founded in Christianity? No, said Jefferson. It was not. It absolutely was not. He said Christianity was not introduced until the 7th century in England, the conversion of the first Christian king of the Heptarchy having taken place in the year 598, and that of the last about 686. Hence, there was a space of 200 years during which the common law of England was in existence and Christianity was no part of it. We might as well say that the Newtonian system of philosophy is a part of the common law as that the Christian religion is. In truth, the alliance between church and state has ever made their judges accomplices in the frauds of the clergy, and even bolder than that they are. Thomas Jefferson writing to James Madison, of all people, who wrote back, essentially, agreeing with him. It was on September 24th, 1821. But enough of the old musty stuff from the founding of this country. Today we have statesmen like Randall Terry, founder of Operation Rescue. Here's a quote from Randall Terry. Quote, I want you to just let a wave of intolerance wash over you. I want you to let a wave of hatred wash over you. Yes, hate is good. Our goal is a Christian nation. We have a biblical duty. We are called by God to conquer this country. When I or people like me are running this country, you'd better flee, because we will find you, we will try you, and we will execute you. End quote. Randall Terry, director of Operation, founder of Operation Rescue. And what happened Wednesday of last week? There was a terrorist incident in the United States. You probably didn't hear much about it. It didn't seem to make the national news. You would think that a terrorist, a member of an underground terror network, a rather extensive one with cells all over the United States, putting together a bomb, a real bomb, a pipe bomb packed with the potassium nitrate and dextrin. The pipe was packed with nails and the propane cylinder with a mechanical timer and a battery. This is a pipe bomb that would have killed anybody within 100 yards of it. It was defused by police in Austin, Texas on Wednesday. They tracked down the guy who made it by tracking the materials back to a Walmart where they were able to get his debit card number. And it turns out it was a guy named Paul Ross Evans. It did not make the news. No national. Here you had a terrorist planting a bomb that was ready to go off, and it was defused at the last minute. You would think that George Bush would be up there saying, "We've stopped a terrorist plot. Look at this. This is marvelous. More money to the FBI. We stopped a terrorist plot." Except for the fact that the bomb was outside an abortion clinic. I guess that doesn't count. That's just the religious trying to take over the country, you see. 27 minutes past the hour. Your call's up next.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
It's listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Listen for those sponsors, particularly those local sponsors, that resonate with you. Let them know that you're listening. Patronize their products. And if you hear ones you don't like, go out and tell folks in your community who are in the business, you know, in the business community, hey, you should advertise on this radio station, because I'd like to buy your products. Also, our national sponsor, SacredGroundsCoffee.com, SmallDog.com, and the organic wine company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, imported French wines, ECOWINE. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Liz in Manhattan. Hey, Liz, welcome to the program.
Yes, how you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. In fact, I'm super great today, Liz, because last night at 7 o'clock, I sent the manuscript for Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion, my next book, off to the publisher. I've been slaving on this thing for a year. It's been driving me crazy. And every weekend, I've been working 10, 12 hours on it, and every afternoon, and finally, I finished it. So I'm super good.
Well, congratulations, Liz.
Thank you, Liz. So what's on your mind?
Okay, it had to do with our gentleman friend that you were talking about, excuse me, who basically said that our founding fathers didn't think exactly that there should be a separation of church and state. These men came from a time where they knew what it was like to live under a monarchy, who knew what it was like to live under a theocratic rulership. They knew exactly what they were saying when they said separation of church and state. They knew exactly what type of power the church will use, bringing to bear against the private citizenry once they had that kind of control. They didn't, these are simple people. They didn't mince words. If they said separation of church and state, they meant separation of church and state. And too many people nowadays, politicians and the like, love to try and play around with words. Oh, well, they meant sort of, they meant this, they didn't exactly mean that because they're all religious. Yes, they were all religious. Yes, they all believed in God, or for most of that, most of them believed in God. But they also did not believe in the rulership of the theocracy.
Yeah, well said. Well said, Liz. Thank you very much for the call. David over here is applauding, my producer. Absolutely. And although a lot of them were deists, which meant that they believed that there was some great force out there, they weren't sure what it was. They didn't think that it interfered in the lives of people. Jefferson, Washington, for example, were good examples. Benjamin Rush, Ben Franklin, they were all deists. But good point. And it was in the previous century, so it wasn't in the memory of their lifetimes. But, you know, in the 1600s, Oliver Cromwell had overthrown the kings of England, and for, what, 7-8 years, something like that, the Puritans ruled the United Kingdom, and the British said, enough of this, and got rid of Oliver Cromwell in a hurry. He said, we'd rather have a king than the Puritans, and that's why the Puritans fled to the United States. Religious persecution? Well, sort of. They wanted to run the country and forbid dancing and singing. Tom in Stratford, Connecticut. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. First of all, congratulations on your book. Can't wait to read it. And
thank
second
you.
Of all,
it'll be out in September.
Great. Second of all, three quick things. The good gentleman or professor from Duquesne apparently has never heard the phrase tyranny of the majority. And per the last caller, one of the reasons the founders were so concerned with tyranny of the majority was in the area of imposing a religion on people.
Which is why we have a republic rather than a pure democracy.
Yeah,
we have a republican democracy.
Yeah, with a Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights sort of serves to delineate where the majority cannot get off telling someone what to do, right? Is that right?
No, that's
And it's simple. It's appalling that a professor could get apparently a PhD and be unaware of Madison. You took away my second point by citing Madison's veto, and so I'll just say about it that he did point out it was a public duty to take care of the poor and educate them, which is a separate point.
Well, provide for the public welfare is one of the six items listed in the preamble of the Constitution as the reason why this country was being brought into being.
Absolutely. And finally, the point I wanted to make was Madison was so intent on the separation of church and state, which we liberals are often accused of trying to be too severe about, he didn't even want the government to be able to count the number of churches and ministers. That's how severe the separation was to be. There was no points of contact of any kind.
Yeah, I didn't know that. But I know that Madison was an absolute fanatic about it. And I just think it's so ironic that Madison, and you read his letters, he's pretty clear about it. His concern was that he didn't want his religion, I mean, you know, his Christian religion, to be contaminated by some politician in Washington, D.C. paying off the church. Jefferson thought, oh, come on, Madison, you're crazy. You don't have to worry about that. You know, the religious guys are so into their religion, they'll never be contaminated. What we really have to worry about is the religious zealots getting into the government and making policy. And Madison was like, oh, come on, the American people would never stand for the religious people taking over the government making policy. And they were both ridiculing each other's paranoia. And they're both right.
And as you say, they had witnessed the sectarian bloodbath. They didn't witness it, but they knew within their grandparents' living memory.
A religious bloodbath.
England was in the 17th century. They were applied historians. We are trying to learn from mistakes that were made. And this gentleman from Duquesne wants to take us right back there.
Yeah, and he's not alone in it. Thank you, Tom. Well said. Michael in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Michael.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. The Bruce guy, he's a total wingnut. I mean, it's pretty frightening that he's actually a professor. But his position was that there was no separation of religion and state, And he also was kind of kept saying that, that the majority of voters support a religious test in government. But what about the fact that Republican voter disenfranchisement and general, you know, voter apathy has kind of created a scenario where you have maybe a majority of the minority that's helping to dictate what's going on with the Bush administration,
which is a whole other problem, and that's and spot on, Michael, and that's why we need to get out there and get active and start getting involved in politics and showing up at the local political parties and showing up at the meetings. It's not enough just to vote. We have to get really and truly active and get more people to vote. Steve in Mountain, thanks for the call. Steve in Mountain View, California. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. So yeah, your earlier caller kind of covered the main point, which is this confusion about democracy, where the majority thinks that they can basically make any rules that they want because they're the majority, which of course is silly.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about that. It's about it's about agreement. It's not about force.
Well, and it's about the kind of country that was brought into being by the founders and framers. I mean, this is what Turkey is struggling with right now, and this is why I started with this story. And thank you for your calls. Well said. Turkey's Supreme Court stopped the vote yesterday, because it looked like the Islamists were going to take control. And there's a consensus in Turkey. Now, perhaps the majority of the people want there to be Islamist control, but there's a consensus among the military and those people who are committed to the institutions of government that Turkey is and is going to remain a secular state. And this is the kind of danger, frankly, that speaking as somebody who considers himself spiritual, I'm not sure I call myself religious, but because that word is just so loaded, this is the danger that religion, organized religion, represents to government. Kurt in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Kurt.
Good morning, Tom. Your first guest really scared me, and this tyranny of the majority is exactly why, as a gay person, as soon as I finish my PhD, I want to get out of this crazy country, because it's not Islamo fascist terrorists from some other country that I'm afraid of. I'm afraid of the Christo-fascist terrorists within this own country.
Kurt, they're not just in this country. I mean, this is why it's so important that instead of leaving the country that you get involved in the political process and help
Tom,
the rest
I've
of us.
I've been involved with everything. As a gay person, I have had to deal with very bad harassment and discrimination in housing and in employment to the point where I had to leave my job with the help of a lawyer, and those people were able to keep their jobs. If there are speed limit signs, that doesn't stop anybody from speeding.
Yeah.
And
I understand, Kurt, and I think
this guy and his
are
religious
changing.
Fanaticism, and even if that's the majority of people that go out and vote, like you said, what's to stop that? Because it's not me and other people that feel like me that aren't. I was out and got arrested with Cindy Sheehan in Washington, D.C., trying to do my part, but it's not working. And personally,
It is working, Kurt. You have a half a dozen states now that have passed gay rights, significant gay rights legislation.
And that's lip service, Tom.
No, it's not. This is the beginning of a movement.
You have not experienced what I have experienced and many other gay people have experienced.
I'll give you that, Kurt. I'll give you that. I can only see it. I have friends who are gay, and I have family members who are. I can only see it in others. But what I am seeing in the United States is that there is change happening. And it's not just gay rights, frankly. And I think you have to agree with me on this.
Yeah, absolutely, I agree with you.
We're talking abortion rights. We're talking, you know, right across the board. And frankly, I think the recent Supreme Court decision demonstrates that the Supreme Court is always about 20 years behind public opinion rather than leading public opinion. They lag public opinion. But, you know, perhaps we're just going to have to agree to disagree, but I hope that you stick around here. No way. Well, okay. Well, Kurt, thank you for the call. Please reconsider. This is a country worth saving. It really is. And we need people like you, Kurt, here in the United States. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls in just a minute. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
young man sitting on the witness stand. The man with the book says, raise your hand. Repeat after me, I solemnly swear. The man looked down at his long hair. And although the young man solemnly swore, nobody seemed to hear anymore. And it didn't really matter if the truth was there. It was the cut of his clothes and the length of his hair. And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth?
Indeed, welcome back. Hey, by the way, join me in Dubrovnik, Croatia, June 3rd through the 9th, for the conference, the Praxis Peace Conference, Transforming Culture from Empire to Global Community. Tom Hayden, George Lakoff, David Corton, Francis Moore LePace, Swami Beyondananda, Rianne Eisler, Praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, peace.org for details. The Prime Minister of Iraq, here again, separation of church and state, the majority of Iraqis are Shia. The Prime Minister is Shia. And the Prime Minister's office has created an agency with the knowledge of the government, of the United States government. It was set up 4 months ago. It's called the Office. They refer to it as the Office. It's actually the Office of the Commander-in-Chief. And it's basically carrying out an extremist Shiite agenda that's making the Sunnis crazy and threatening to destroy the country of Iraq. The government of Iraq, the semblance of government of Iraq. Again, you know, religion trumping democracy. There has to be, if we're going to have democracy, there have to be barriers against religion, in my opinion. Jeff in Austin, and in the opinion of the founders, Jeff in Austin, Texas. Hey, Jeff, it was in your town that the abortion clinic bomb went off, or almost went off last week.
Hey, good morning, Tom. Love the show. Yeah.
Thank you.
I heard you say that. You had mentioned it in passing. And there's a large population of the city here kind of wondering why this wasn't nationalized. This is a big deal. I mean, it wasn't just a bomb. They actually exploded it. This is not the same as some kid calling in a bomb at a high school. This was somebody actually planted a bomb, Timothy McVeigh-ish. Of course, it wasn't as big as Oklahoma, but with intent. And I'm just kind of curious why the government didn't see that as an act of terrorism, as you had said.
Well, they did. They're actually prosecuting. They're prosecuting the guy under the terrorist laws.
Right,
but it got no publicity.
There's also something that is very curious here. They didn't mobilize the National Guard here in Texas for this. They used good police work, and I do not disagree that this person is not a terrorist. I agree that they are, but shouldn't terrorism be dealt with law versus being dealt with soldiers? We have a so-called war on drugs, and I won't agree or I don't want to go into how successful that is, but the point being is we're using police work there, not soldiers.
Yeah.
And this war on terrorism could be just something that's used, and I don't want to quote John Kerry here, but it's definitely something it could be better used the FBI or the Central Intelligence Agency and not our guys overseas. And I know you're talking about separation of church and state, and I didn't want to go off there, but it is
a very good point,
and I think it's been squelched.
Yeah, no, I think your point is well taken, Jeff. That it's good old fashioned police work that tracked down this bomber, and it's police work that we should be using if we want to stop people who are potential terrorists. And now we have Christian terrorists in the United States, from Tim McVeigh through Eric Rudolph through this guy last week in Austin, Texas. And you know, other than McVeigh, well, Rudolph got a fair amount of publicity, but for a long time they thought at first he was Muslim. Ken in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Great to listen to your show. I've been listening to it for about 3 years now. And it occurred to me, listening to your first guest, that there's a debate. Now, I'm a Christian, but I look at my religion as my belief system. And he seemed to think that my belief system should allow me certain rights, and that kind of scares me. The Constitution talks about the freedom of religion, people to choose what type of belief system they have, whether there's a deity or not. But asking that religion somehow becomes an entity in itself and some type acquires some type of consideration through the government scares me. You know,
me too.
It's like a third party or another party.
It is. It's a whole other entity. You're spot on, Ken. And the Bush administration has enshrined it with their so-called faith-based initiative programs, handing over $1 billion to religious organizations before the 2004 election. Gee, what a surprise. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie.
Hi, Tom. The guest from Duquesne University confused me on a smaller level. He implied how secularism in ancient Egypt would be ridiculous. Do you remember that?
Right, yeah. He's,
okay.
I don't think it was an argument that was logically defensible.
Yeah, I didn't understand that. And I was thinking, well, the ideas of secularism and democracy hadn't evolved yet. It would be no different than implying that Christianity or Buddhism in ancient Egypt would be ridiculous. And then on a more larger point, I think what he was trying to say is that we're not letting religious people vote or something like that. I think it's perfectly fine for religious people to use their religion to inform their decisions on how they vote. But nobody can stop that. And nobody's trying to stop that. And I really get upset, well, not upset, but I just get a little frustrated whenever Christians or any kind of religious people think that they're being discriminated against whenever, in particular, the Christians are in the majority.
Yeah. The oldest trick of oppression is to claim victimhood. Bonnie, well said. Thank you. Michelle in Baton Rouge, Louisiana on KEUN. Hey, Michelle.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. What's up?
I would like to invite that professor from Duquesne to go and live in a theocracy before he asks for one here. Iran would.
Well, he's suggesting we already have one. He says the election of 2004 was a plebiscite, and it was when the American people decided that they actually want religion to control government.
I totally disagree with that. The other thing is that even if there were a theocracy here, it would not be the Catholic theocracy that he would like. It would be some fundamentalist Bible-thumping theocracy that very, very many of us would be oppressed by.
Yeah, more of a left-behind variety of the Protestant theocracy that George Bush subscribes to. Scary stuff. Scary stuff. In the next hour, we're going to continue this conversation, and also I want to get into some of the other issues of the day. In particular, what's going on with the immigration issues that happened yesterday. We'll be right back.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
In other news, as they say, welcome back to the program. In other news, the president, of course, yesterday vetoed the legislation that was passed by both the House and the Senate. In a bipartisan way, by the way. That is to say, both, there were Republicans. There were only two in the Senate. There were a few more than that in the House, as I recall, who voted for this piece of legislation that many of us frankly objected to because we felt it would allow this occupation to continue to put our soldiers in harm's way and continue to inflame the insurgency for another year. I mean, many of us were looking at this piece of legislation going, hey, wait a minute, this is, you know, let's stop this thing tomorrow morning. But nonetheless, I think that there's a broad consensus or a consensus has developed even among the anti-war groups. And although I realize that I speak on their behalf at considerable peril, and so I'm not attempting to. Speaking for myself as an opponent, not only of this war, but of war in general, of all offensive wars. I would say that I think that a consensus has developed that at least this is a great start, and Bush won't even go for this. So what should the Democrats do? John Edwards has suggested that what the Senate should do and the House should do is just turn around, submit the exact same legislation for another vote, see if they can pick up a few more Republican votes, and my guess is that they will, and resubmit it to the president. Then he'll veto it. He has enough money to continue his little war, his occupation, through the end of August. Not to mention the fact that the Pentagon has somehow managed to lose $2 trillion, which is four times the entire cost of the Iraq war over the last 5 years. Maybe they can find some of that $2 trillion and, you know, fund the war themselves, you know, whatever. But in any case, he has enough cash right now in the bank from previous authorizations to go through the end of August. So just keep sending him the same bill. Through May, through June, through July. And then, you know, you've got a couple of weeks in August to say, okay, we'll give you another 2 months. You can have September and October. And then in October, you can have another 2 months. And just keep, and the whole point is not about making Bush look bad. I mean, I know that that's the major right-wing spin, the major right-wing talking point, the stuff that we're getting from the RNC. You know, it's all, oh, the Democrats are trying to play politics, so they're trying to make the president look bad, trying to score points. They're looking at the 2008 election. No. This has to do with doing what the people of the United States want done. The people of the United States, by and large, the vast majority of the citizens of the United States, regardless of political affiliation, believe that we should not be participating in an ongoing civil war in Iraq. It's time for us to bring the other countries in the region into this area and say, okay, you guys, yeah, we've built these seven giant bases and we've built the largest U.S. complex, 110 acres, in the green zone, on the prime property on the Tigris River, for the so-called U.S. Embassy, which is actually a new city inside Baghdad. Yeah, we've done all this, and we're going to turn it over to you. We'll turn it over to the Arab League. We'll turn it over to a coalition of countries. We'll turn it over to NATO. We'll turn it over to the United Nations, actually, would probably be the best. Like we're doing it, like Bill Clinton did in Bosnia. Let's just say, enough. I mean, it's amazing that in 1999, George W. Bush was calling for timetables when Clinton was talking about involving himself in the Balkans. Nancy Pelosi points this out, by the way.
The president wants a blank check. The Congress is not going to give it to him. The president said in his comments that he did not believe in timelines and he spoke out very forcefully against them. Yet, in 1999... and June 5th, then-Governor Bush said...
Now, this was speaking about Bill Clinton's adventure into the Balkans to stop the civil war there and stop the slaughter.
About President Clinton, I think it's important for the president to lay out a timetable as to how long they will be involved and when they would be withdrawn.
How long they will be involved and when they will be withdrawn. This is Bush. So I'm with John Edwards on this. And many others. I don't think that a so-called clean bill, end quote, with no timelines and no end and, oh, here's another year's worth of money, I think that giving that to Bush would be a disaster, frankly. It would just be a disaster. It's going to be very, very interesting to watch how this all gets played out, how the Democrats respond to this. Also, the other point that I wanted to make in this hour and just, you know, open it up for your thoughts, because I think this is a really interesting one. Today's Wall Street Journal, typically I don't spend much time on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal because it is so right-wing. It is so conservative. It's so conservative, Rupert Murdoch tried yesterday to buy it. Fit right in with Fox News and the New York Post, right? Ah, yes, it's right along. Which, by the way, spiked the price of the Dow Jones stock from 30 some odd to 50 some odd dollars. Now it's in play. But in any case, today's editorial, the lead editorial, the upper left hand corner. In this editorial, the quote conservatives end quote, publishing the Wall Street Journal, came right out and said it. That the whole immigration issue is about cheap labor. As you know, I've been saying for years, we don't have an illegal immigration problem. This is not about the individuals. This is not about creating criminals among people who are looking for work. This is about illegal employers. And the reason that these illegal employers are being allowed to continue to operate is because as illegal employers employ people who are not authorized to work in this country, it expands the labor force and thus drives down the cost of labor. Drive down the cost of labor, and what happens? You increase profits. It doesn't reduce the cost of products. It increases profits. When Phil Knight went from country to country to country, finding cheaper, ever cheaper places to make Nikes, just a good business decision, right? It was legal. Still is. When he did that, did the price of Nikes go down? When designers, you know, when Versace or whoever, when Calvin Klein, you know, when they find a cheaper country to manufacture their clothes, does the price of their clothing go down? No. David Ricardo, probably one of the most famous economists in history, in 1818, or was it 1816, published a piece called On Profits, a little booklet, in which he pointed out that the price of a product in the marketplace is not a function of its cost to the manufacturer. It's a function of what the marketplace will bear. It's a function of the perception of value in the marketplace and the competition in the marketplace. It has nothing to do with the cost. So if manufacturers can drive down their labor costs, what happens? The price of the product doesn't go down. The price of profits, the volume of profits goes up. And so here you have with the Wall Street Journal. Yesterday's May Day immigration demonstrations dominated cable TV, but they are more sound than substance. The bigger news is the recent Journal report that illegal border crossings have slowed by more than 10% this year. The Bush administration credits stepped up enforcement, but our guess is the cause is mostly labor supply and demand. A slump in the housing market has resulted in fewer jobs in the building trades, which are increasingly filled by Latino immigrants. With fewer jobs available, fewer immigrants are headed north. It's another example of the market's ability to determine how much foreign labor our economy needs. Right. Needs to drive down wages. Needs to destroy the middle class. And then they go on to say, we'd like to think these economic realities will inform any legislation produced this year. The Wall Street Journal, their editorial today, just laying it out openly, nakedly, candidly, frankly, saying businesses want to retain their best workers and not see them sent home by the feds, right? In other words, we shouldn't have this touchback thing. They should just be able to keep anybody who's working for them, whether they have the authority, the legal authority to work in this country or not. And then they call for a guest worker program. Yes, let's embrace the Bracero program again. Let's have legalized slavery in the United States. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
They give the money, but he runs the show. To him, you don't say no. You get no say-so veto.
My veto would be...
22 minutes. Yeah. Right now. But let's see how time plays out. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, May 6th at 2 p.m., the University of Judaism will be presenting The Impact of Talk Radio, a seminar. This year's panel will include me, plus Bill Handel, Doug McIntyre, and Dennis Prager. To register, please call 310-440-1246. 310-440-1246. I just want to wrap up this piece. The two issues that I see at the top of the news today. Three issues. The issue of the ongoing issue of theocracy. Frankly, one of the things that we're finding at the core of so many of these appointments, the whole Gonzo-gate thing with the attorney general putting 30-something recent graduates of Pat Robertson's conservative, you know, bottom tier law school in charge of hiring and firing senior federal officials. because there's a religious agenda or a political agenda, number one. Number two, the corporatist agenda of cheap labor. And number three, of course, the veto of the Iraq war, or the veto of the bill that would have forced George W. Bush to sort of start wrapping up the Iraq war. Here's the irony. Here's the super irony, by the way, on that. If Bush signed that law and said, okay, I'll do it, and he spent the next few months putting together everything in place to start pulling our troops out, and starting in October, started drawing down the troops so that by April, there was basically only between 40 and 60,000 U.S. troops left in Iraq, and they themselves were deployed to our military bases to be there in the event of some cataclysmic disaster. And other countries within the region were brought in to help stabilize the area, and whatever political solution was worked out, whether it was separating the country into three or whether it was, you know, whatever it may be. If Bush did that so that by April of next year, there was relative peace and calm in Iraq, it would help the Republicans tremendously in the 2008 elections. The piece of legislation that the Democrats gave to Bush would help the Republicans tremendously. In fact, it may be the last chance for a Republican presidential candidate to actually become president is if Bush does what the Democrats are asking him to do. Because if this war is still going on, or this occupation is still going on in 2008, I don't think any Republican, unless it's Chuck Hagel or Gordon Smith, neither of whom have declared for the presidency, a Republican who has already come out and said that the war is wrong or it's criminal or they're opposed to it, I don't think that any Republican has a chance of succeeding in the race for presidency. It's that toxic. So we have that. Plus this thing yesterday, of course, May Day, we talked about this, and the pro-immigrant, what would you call them, marches, parades, celebrations in some cases. And in Los Angeles, I think maybe you can call it a police riot. I'll let the people of Los Angeles tell me what they think it was. But in any case, here's the Wall Street Journal editorializing about it today. And they say that given that illegal immigration is caused, above all, by a worker shortage for certain types of jobs in the U.S., now, that's a framing device. That's called a frame. I mean, that's a predicating assumption that is wrong, right? What they're saying, there's no shortage of there's no shortage of workers for jobs in the United States. There's a shortage of employers who are willing to pay a decent wage. Anyhow, they say that given that illegal immigration is caused above all by a worker shortage for certain types of jobs in the U.S., any reform that doesn't take into account labor market needs won't solve the problem and risks making matters worse. They say that the immigration draft proposal ignores economic factors and is unduly restrictive. And then they talk about the $1,500 that people are going to have to pay to get a visa to come back into the United States with this legislation that the Democrats and Bush are supportive of. They say this is a tax on workers. Businesses want to retain their best workers, not see them sent home by the feds. They say, we think a realistic guest worker program would make sense both for the U.S. economy and the needs of post-9/11 security. Any reform failing to recognize labor market realities is worse than no reform at all. Say, what? Yeah, let's just go back to the Bracero program. Let's have, you know, legalized pseudo-slavery, essentially, in the United States. And let's make sure that there's an unlimited supply of labor so that the cost of labor is continuously dropping in the United States. Because we don't need no stinking middle class. All they do is get out on the streets and yell about democracy. We want an impoverished, terrified working class who are afraid to speak out for fear they'll lose their jobs. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
One for all, it's all for one. Let's start a union, call it every.
Coming up on May 11th, by the way, KLSD in San Diego, 1360, AM 1360. It's going to be putting together a listener party. I'll be there at the Cosmopolitan Restaurant in San Diego Old Town. It'll be from 4 to 8 p.m. If you want more information about that, you can call 858-292-2000. 858-292-2000 for more information about the listener party at the Cosmopolitan Restaurant in San Diego's Old Town. Put on May 11th by KLSD, AM 1360 in San Diego. Should be a hoot. John Shimkus has just summarized the Republican congressman from Illinois, the Springfield area, the guy representing the district that Abraham Lincoln, the Republican representing the district that Abraham Lincoln once, you know, where Abraham Lincoln was born, as I recall, just crystallized everything that is wrong, in my opinion, with the Republican view of this whole issue with, regarding the war in Iraq, and that is that they're viewing this thing as if it's a sports game. Politics is not sports. It's not about my team versus your team. People are dying in Iraq. As we speak, there are families burying their loved ones, their children, their parents, their brothers, their sisters, their wives, their husbands. Not just Americans, Iraqis as well. And all around the world, the name of the United States is being dragged through the mud as a result of this crusade and occupation. And Shimkus gets up on the floor of the House of Representatives and says, no, this is how we should think of the war in Iraq.
Speaker, imagine my beloved St. Louis Cardinals are playing the much-despised Chicago Cubs. The Cardinals are up by 5, finishing the top of the 9th. Is this a cause for celebration? Is this a cause for victory? No. Unbelievable as it may seem, the Cubbies score 5 runs in the bottom of the 9th to throw the game into extra innings.
See, what he's saying is, you know, maybe we can still have something to work out here.
There, the score remains until 1 a.m., 5 innings later. However, at the top of the 15th, the Cardinals fail to field a batter. The entire team has left the stadium. It seems that they are more worried about next day's 1 p.m. game at home than finishing the game at hand. Who wins? We know it's the team that stays on the field. Arbitrary deadlines and a date certain accept defeat before the conclusion of the contest.
See, this is the point that was thrown at me on Fox News on Sunday morning. Oh, you guys just want to wave the white flag of surrender. It's all about defeat. No, occupations are not won or lost. Occupations are resolved by political processes. We already won the war. It was an illegal war. The people who put it together, who sold it to us, should be put in prison, frankly, for it, or at least stand trial in the International Court of Criminal Justice at The Hague for war crimes. It was an illegal war, but the war was successful. And when George Bush declared on May 1st, 4 years ago yesterday, that the war was over and or that the major combat operations were over, that essentially we had won the war, he was right. And then began the occupation, and here we are now, 4 years into the occupation of Iraq with more dead Americans than died in 9/11. Just since then, not that 9/11 has anything to do with this, because Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, but nonetheless, I mean, you know, comparing Bush metaphors to Bush metaphors. This is crazy. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jerry in Maplewood, New Jersey. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
Yes, a couple of points, if I could. People have the problem of equating morality and religion. So the more religious you are, the more moral you're going to be. So when the politicians establish their religion, they take the morality and they twist and turn people emotionally with it to get them to go to either side, which is very bad. But watching the way that George Bush presented himself when he vetoed that bill yesterday, he's been asking for a war czar, which he admittedly can't run the war. Here he had hundreds of applicants through that bill that was submitted to him, and he's not accepting their applications by him denying it. And these guys have background in budgets and foreign policy, and they're the best qualified, and he's turning them down, and I don't understand it.
He's turning people down to be his war czar?
Well, yeah. the House. I mean, let them be the war czar.
Frankly, we already have a war czar. It's called the Commander in Chief, and the Constitution provides for it. And yeah, exactly. And that's the President of the United States. And what Bush is trying to do is, and what Karl Rove has brilliantly done up to this point, and Dick Cheney have brilliantly done, is pin all the blame for this disaster on George Tenet. And I'm not here to defend George Tenet at all, but he's rip-roaring mad about it, and as well he should be, although he willingly participated in this little tea party and deserves all the blame for that. I think that he should be in the docket in The Hague along with the rest of them, frankly. But they are, you know, the bottom line here is it's pin the tail on the donkey. I mean, it's pin the tail on the donkey. Doug in Staten Island. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Hi, how are you? It's good to talk to you, Tom.
Thank you.
A few thoughts. You know, I'm just so happy that this station exists because it allows for a little bit less of the coarsening of the dialogue that's gone on with this right-wing radio. What seems to be the overlying theme of your show, I think, is the intellectual dishonesty that's practiced by, I mean, you have the Duquesnean professor of the intellectual dishonesty of the sophistry of thinking that some sort of moral dictum is not meant as a template for your immortal soul, but is supposed to be some sort of a constitutional basis for a civil democracy. You have the H2A program for guest workers that are basically, I think Charlie Rangel said it was the closest thing he's ever seen to slavery. I suggest to your readers to take a look at the Southern Poverty Law Center report, Close to Slavery. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting history of what's going on with this program. But, you know, for our gay friend who thinks that he needs to leave, I just want to remind him that on a historical perspective here, this is not the first time that this Christo-fascism, as he puts it, has reared its head. It's not even the most virulent form, but it's something to worry about. I mean, if you read books like Becoming Eichmann or take a look at de Tocqueville's Admonitions in Democracy in America, where he says America seems to feel that they're the only religious, enlightened, and free people, and they form a species apart from the human race.
Yeah, what I found most interesting, de Tocqueville wrote that in 1836, and I quoted it somewhat extensively in one of the later chapters in my book, Unequal Protection, because he had one of his closing chapters was titled, What America Has to Fear. Or words to that effect. And he basically describes with startling prescience right now, this period in time. It's absolutely spooky. But yeah, good point and well made, Doug. Thank you very much. Scott in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Tom. Look forward to seeing you. If I can get somebody to help me carry it, I'll bring Ultimate Sacrifice for you to sign.
That's a big business.
It's a hell of a read, but it was, I could read it in the wind. In a wind machine, a wind tunnel.
Yeah.
Anyway, if I become a war czar, I'll make everybody join the Nazi Quaker Church. We'll start wars, and then we'll refuse to fight. Problem solved.
Okay. Great.
Why I called, actually. You got me started. Sure. Now, you mentioned the Wall Street Journal and Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah.
Last night on the Charlie Rose Show on PBS, Ken Auletta, who's a media writer for the New Yorker, was saying that the family that owns the Wall Street Journal and that whole company, Murdoch was like dead last on the list of potential buyers in their estimation, with USA Today's company, Gannett, second to last. And if they ever did sell, they would sell it to Post Newsweek, the Graham family, or Bloomberg.
I thought the Post had been bought from the Graham family.
Didn't
they like take that thing public or something like that?
And, yeah, it's
the
public.
The family no longer basically controls it.
It's public, but I think they own the controlling shares.
I see.
I'm not a reader of the Wall Street Journal, but I thank my Anglo-Saxon Protestant upright God that Murdoch didn't get his grubby hands on it because, I mean, good Lord Agnes, don't we have enough problems with the right wing media?
Yeah, well, yes, and the Wall Street Journal, their editorial page, like I said, is the right-wing media. And in fact, very often offers the talking points for right-wing talk radio. Their reporting, actually, is some of the best reporting that's going on in the country. And we have to give credit where credit's due, I guess. Carlos in San Diego. Hey, Carlos, got to take a break in about a minute. What's up?
Okay, this will be quick. Yeah, I look forward to seeing you when you come to San Diego. Last night I went and heard Jeremy Scahill, author of the Blackwater book,
yeah.
The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army.
He was
Army.
A guest on this program about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, and he said that many of his speaking tours, people come up to him, excuse me, I'm coughing, that worked for Blackwater, and they say it's much worse than he knows. And this connects with that right wing, the owner of Blackwell. Blackwater, of course, is Eric Prince, an extreme right wing zealot Christo fascist. So, this is Bush's army of choice. This is Rumsfeld's army of choice, and they don't have any compunction with unleashing it on the American citizenry.
Well, they certainly let them loose on New Orleans, but I'm not, let's hope this is a legal enterprise what Blackwater is doing. And frankly, what I think we should be having in this country is, rather than blanketly condemning them or, for that matter, praising them, we should be having a dialogue about, do we want private armies in our country? And if so, what limits are we going to put on them, both domestically and internationally? 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
One thing I've learned, when Americans get burned, they won't just sit and complain. They know their rights, stand up and fight for jobs that are fair and humane. When those Walmart guys hear the word unionize, they go completely insane. They'll find out who, and boy, if it's you, you're in for a world of pain. Yeah, I got friends with low wages. They work for Walmart in outrageously bad conditions. Cause the union's missing.
Coming up on May 17th, by the way, I'll be in Denver, Colorado. KKZN, AM 760 is putting this thing together. I'll be doing a live show from the Boulder Theater, 9 a.m. to noon, when our program is live. You can check it out at am760.net, their website. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. on the line with us. Hey, Ellen.
The president is meeting very shortly with congressional leadership to talk about the supplemental bill. And, of course, according to Tony Snow this morning and right now during the press briefing, they're really not going to make much movement. And, in fact, Tony said that the Democrats ought to be asking, that the press ought to be asking the Democrats some questions about what they're going to do to move towards the White House. Meanwhile, the CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, has come out with a study that they released today, and they essentially said, this is Andrew Kordsman, that if they just start immediately, it might lead to a civil war, but it may simply leave just a shattered nation. It may be a humanitarian disaster, but good chance it's not going to be genocide. And the administration is ignoring the fact around this al-Qaeda issue that the Sunni resistance to al-Qaeda has grown quite a bit, and that al-Qaeda has plenty of other training grounds, including Egypt, Morocco, and lots of other countries. So that this sort of doom and gloom that the administration has been putting forth may not be correct.
Right. Well, and they're trying to conflate al-Qaeda, which is basically a Sunni, it's sort of like saying I'm a member of the Seventh-day Adventist. I don't want to
Right, I know what you're saying.
At Adventist, but it's basically the Adventists or the Mormons or whatever. I mean, you know, pick a religion that's not part of mainstream Protestantism, and you know, waving a flag. Actually, it's an imperfect metaphor. I shouldn't even use it. Instead, let's just say the Al Qaeda in Iraq is not the Al Qaeda that attacked the United States. They're completely different people.
And they've done a lot of morphing.
Yeah, and number one, and number two, you know, I believe you're right. Plus, if we get out of Iraq, the other countries in the region are going to get in. They're going to participate in helping put that country back together, because it is not in their interest. You know, Saudi Arabia doesn't want to have an unstable country on their border. Syria doesn't want to have an unstable country on their border. Iran doesn't want to have an unstable country on their border. So Turkey doesn't, you know, want to have an unstable country on their border.
Well, speaking of Iraq, two other issues. First of all, Mr. Waxman of the House is going to actually doing a whole other series of hearings, and one of the things that he's going to be focusing on in the very near future is war profiteering. Don't really have a whole lot more information on that, but that's definitely going to be a focus. Also, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, it's a 10-member committee. I think it has 4 Democrats and 6 Republicans, because it was originally appointed by when the Republicans had power. They say that religious freedom in Iraq has now been put on the watch list, where worship is under severe threat. 3 of the 4 Democrats said that the commission should have taken a much further step on this.
That's interesting. What, Ellen, what's the consensus view among the press, or what's your opinion of what the Democrats will be doing in response to the Bush veto?
It's really hard to say. I mean, the Democrats are clearly pushing some benchmarks, and what we're also hearing is that many of the Republicans are now saying that they are concerned that if there is not real progress by September, that they are willing to really take the president, you know, and really put the heat on.
Yeah. This is the point that I made earlier in the program, is that if Bush had signed this law, this appropriation, and if he had followed it and started drawing down our forces this fall and completely got out of Iraq by April, it would be the best thing that could happen to the Republican Party for the elections in November of 2008.
Well, of course it would. Of course it would. But you know, who knows whether he's going to be. I mean, he's a very rigid guy. And yeah, he may not want to listen to those guys either.
I mean, they could declare victory and go home. I think that he would resurrect his reputation in history to a certain extent, to the extent that he could rewrite it anyway. And the Republicans would be able to claim some victory. And there's an added bonus. If anything goes wrong in Iraq, the Republicans could blame the Democrats for it. I mean,
exactly.
This just seems like it's all upside. There's no downside.
That would be the politically sensible thing for Mr. Bush to do. But
yeah,
he's not always politically sensible.
Well, at what point are there going to be enough Republicans in the House and Senate? I think it's already veto-proof in the House.
I think
if
you see the kind of deaths that we're seeing and chaos in Iraq in September, because now they just added 4 more thousand troops into the surge, I think, this week, well, today, you know, this week.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
you see this kind of thing going on, it will be end of the movie by September in terms of Republicans turning.
Yeah. And in other words, the Republicans have figured this out, too, and they want to have this thing resolved by spring of 2008 so that they can have a clean campaign going into the fall of 2008, campaigning as the guys who won the war, who put the war behind them, and, you know, vote for us, we're the good guys.
Most likely so. If I have just one more second, I want to say a couple other things not related to the war, but the Food and Drug Administration is now trying to increase their warnings on antidepressants to include 18 to 24-year-olds. They have found that there is an increased risk to people taking antidepressants up to 24 years old. As you know, their authorization bill is now before Congress, and so they're becoming
right,
a little more responsive.
This is a risk of suicide, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Always good talking with you. Coming up next.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Our quote for the day from the first Republican to be elected President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, democracy is the government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Our quote for the day from the first Republican. Here's a short quote from the most recent Republican president.
If it feels good, do it. And if you got a problem, blame it on somebody else.
Yeah. And to what extent is that kind of mentality infecting our society and our culture? Are the solutions to all problems, particularly problems involved with raising kids, to be found simply in shipping them off to an industry that seems to be making a whole lot of money on that? Sometimes you know what you know. Sometimes you don't know what you know. Sometimes you don't even know what you don't know. In our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment today, as the Fire Sign Theater would say,
you know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Maya Salovitz is with us. She's a senior fellow at the media watchdog group Stats and author of Help at Any Cost, How the Troubled Teen Industry Cons Parents and Hurts Kids. The website, helpatanycost.com. Maya, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome, and we're pleased to have you here. You're doing great work. You talk about how Nancy Reagan was promoting these programs back, and so much of this stuff goes back to the Reagan administration. It just boggles my mind.
Yes.
We've got these programs where kids are being shipped off because they've admitted to their parents that they're gay. They're being shipped off because they've used drugs. They're being shipped off because their parents consider them discipline problems because they're not doing well in school. And many of these kids, many, you know, 30 that you've documented, have died in some of these places.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned the sort of if it feels good, do it outlook on life, because a lot of the schools present themselves as an alternative to that. We're going to make the kids see the consequences of their actions. But what they don't understand is that generally when kids are acting out, it is not because they have too much and are too happy. It is generally because they are not getting what they need.
I think you can take that right across the board. You could say that about Iraqis as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
this is the human condition.
Yeah, exactly. And when people are, receiving all the stuff that they need, they tend to be more generous and kind. It is not a situation where pain makes people into good people. We understand that empathy makes people into good people, but just inflicting pain on people actually does not produce empathy.
Yeah. I watched this whole, the rise of this industry back in the late 70s, 78 to 83. I was the executive director of a residential treatment facility in New Hampshire, the New England Salem Children's Village, for severely abused and emotionally disturbed kids. And we were watching this whole for-profit industry emerge and really capture the public's imagination with these fluff pieces on the network news and 60 Minutes kind of programs about these so-called boot camp programs and the so-called tough love stuff. And, you know, the experience that I had, both as a parent of three children and as the executive director, the guy who ran an institution for children who had been the victims of what their parents thought was tough love.
Yes.
I mean, we literally, one of the first kids I did intake on, his brother had been starved to death in the basement of the house.
Oh,
another
God.
Kid that we did intake on, it had something like 11 broken bones. I mean, it's these, and in every case, and I very often had to end up interviewing these parents as well, and they always said, they were just trying to do the best thing for their kid. And I think that most of them actually believed that. They just didn't know how to parent.
No, and I mean, I think the really amazing thing when writing this book that kept occurring to me is that, like, we recognize that, like, beating the crap out of a young, a 2- and a 3-year-old is child abuse, but we think that doing this to a teenager is going to help them. It's so backwards, and it's so contrary to everything we know about human nature and what makes people into kind, caring, supportive human beings. And yet it has an irresistible pitch to it, because what has happened by the time teenagers are in their adolescence. They're often arguing with their parents. They are not that nice, calm, compliant little kid anymore. And the parents are not so happy about the separation, and the kids have really gotten them angry. And so this tough stuff appeals in some sense because it seems, you know, it almost it's almost a revenge. Now, that's not
well, it's reasserting power.
Exactly. And that's not to say that most parents who send their kids to these places actually want that. I would say that's only a minority. Many parents are just sucked in by they have been told that this is the only thing that works, and if you're a really good parent, you will, you know, sort of grit your teeth and let us hurt your child like you would for a vaccine. And so most of the parents are genuinely decent parents who are sucked in by a rhetoric that, like, the only way to help your kid is to hurt them.
Mm-hmm. I would submit to let me lay out a hypothesis here, and I'd love to get your take on it. We're talking with Maya Salovitz. The website is helpatanycost.com. Her book, Help at Any Cost, How the Troubled Teen Industry Cons Parents and Hurts Kids. I talk on this program a lot about the fundamental difference going all the way back to the founding of this country and arguably way back into European history and the history of other cultures between liberals and conservatives, that the traditional liberal worldview is that people are decent and that the world is a reasonable place, and that the goal of institutions in society, be they whatever they may be, even government, is to help people achieve the maximum potential that derives from that decency. The fundamental conservative worldview is that, going back to the notion of original sin all the way into Genesis, is that people are fundamentally evil. They're evil probably because of a mistake that a woman made, which has been used for 6,000-7,000 years to justify the oppression of women, and that the purpose of public institutions from government on down is to restrain that natural evil from being acted out. I would guess that the kind of parents who would enthusiastically send the kids to their kids to these kind of programs, and the kind of people who run and promote these programs, share that conservative worldview and really and truly believe that what they're doing is helping build self-control to restrain the intrinsic evil that's inside all of us.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes, and there's a very strong strain of that in the schools that are run by explicitly so-called Christian organizations. And, you know, the idea of spare the rod is definitely deeply in there.
Though that doesn't appear in the Bible, spare the rod is an old Ben Franklinism. But
on the other hand, though, you do get, there is this sort of hippie strain of this as well that comes out of Synanon from the 70s. And it comes from this idea that expressing your feelings, especially your anger, is always good. It's interesting because I don't think this would have caught on without sort of having a piece to appeal to both the liberal and the conservative imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And the liberal piece appeals to this idea that, like, getting your emotions out is always good. And nothing is always good.
Right. And in fact, there was primal therapy back in the 70s that was a big fad for about 2 years, and then they discovered that it was causing psychosis.
Exactly.
And what happens is that when people take a plastic baseball bat and beat a pillow and start screaming at it as if it was their parent or whatever, and essentially reenact and relive trauma, it re-traumatizes them, and it reinforces that trauma.
Yes, and this is exactly what those programs still do. In fact, one of the biggest programs that I write about in my book on the Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs literally has part of its seminar where kids spend hours beating on pillows expressing their rage.
Oh, this is totally discredited in the late 70s.
Absolutely. And the thing that I was trying to, you know, one of the key points I was trying to make with the book is just that, like, we know this stuff is discredited. We know the idea that if you attack people and humiliate them and break them down through these various things like the screaming and all this, like, another one of their favorite things is, you know, put somebody in the hot seat and shout at them and humiliate them and degrade them. Again, this traumatizes them or re-traumatizes them if they were originally traumatized. And so we know this stuff doesn't work. We know, in fact, that it makes kids worse, and yet we continue to do it. And this is why I personally believe so strongly that we need to, when we are doing mental health care, prove something safe and effective before we use it.
Mm-hmm. We need an FDA for psychology.
Sort of, yeah.
As it were.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Maya Salovitz, we're pretty much out of time here, but it's great work that you're doing. Senior fellow at the Media Watchdog Group, Stats. What's the website for that?
It is stats.org.
Okay. And author of Help at Any Cost, How the Troubled Teen Industry Cons Parents and Hurts Kids. And the website for the book is helpatanycost.com. Maya, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work and keep spreading the message. It's an important one. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry Scott, the editor of and founder of VAWatchdog.org, going to give us the state of veterans affairs right after this. Then we'll get back into the news and your calls. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody is free. And that's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
Hey, let me shout out to my friends in Santa Fe. KTRC is putting on a gig 2 p.m. The doors open at 1:30 at the Greer Garson Theater for presentation and, doing the show and whatnot, and a speech and book signing. This is May 19th. So to get free tickets, listen to KTRC in Santa Fe and find out how. 21 minutes past the hour. Larry Scott on the line with us, our old friend who is the founder, editor, chief cook and bottle washer over at VAWatchdog.org, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to.
That's right, Tom.
And certainly Jim Nicholson isn't.
Jim Nicholson, by the way, for the listeners who may not know the name, is our Secretary of Veterans Affairs of the Department of Veterans Affairs. A wonderful gentleman he is, too. His only qualifications being that he used to be the chairman of the Republican National Committee.
Yeah, and a big donor to the Bush campaign.
And yeah, well, it's crazy. A man with no veterans advocacy, no real management skills to handle an $80+ billion agency, and they put him in charge. And you know, they try to get him to clean up. Speaking of Jim Nicholson, you know, we've talked about before, Tom, the seamless transition program that the military and the VA are supposed to have. And what this is when our troops are injured or wounded, they come home and they're in the military healthcare system, and there's supposed to be a transition that when they're discharged from the military, then they can move into the VA system. This is for veterans, for those who are disabled and those who are injured. Now, this program has been in effect for years, called Seamless Transition. It hasn't been working, and Walter Reed pointed that out. So everybody says, let's fix it. We've got to fix it. We've got to make it work. Well, the White House came down, President Bush himself. He took Jim Nicholson, and he basically told the man who creates the red tape, you cut through this red tape, and you've got 45 days to do it. Interestingly enough, Jim Nicholson formed a task force that came up with 25 really good recommendations for solving these problems, for making sure our injured and wounded troops were taken care of, to help them with their discharge, to facilitate their movement into VA health care. Wonderful things. And I'm reading through this list of 25, and I said, we have a problem here. And the problem is there's no money. There's no more personnel. How can they do this? This doesn't make any sense.
Well, Larry, you've got to have money for tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires.
Exactly right, you do, Tom.
I mean, you know what? We can't take care of vets. We've got to take care of the millionaires and billionaires first.
You know, and so I went back, and hidden right in front of my eyes, like a goofball, I missed it the first time around, Tom, but hidden right in front of my eyes was why there were no recommendations for additional funding and additional personnel. The mandate from the White House to VA Secretary Nicholson was, you must do this, and this is an exact quote, using existing resources. From the White House to the VA and to the Department of Defense, you have all of these problems, fix them, but you can't have any more people and you can't have any more money. That tells you exactly what this administration thinks of our troops and thinks of our veterans. It's
now, why is it that this administration would think that giving $8 billion in welfare checks to the oil industry is going to somehow help solve our energy problem, but giving $50 to the Veterans Administration is throwing money at a problem?
Well, that's it, and I think you're exactly right there, throwing money at a problem. You've got to understand the concept of veterans' benefits. Veterans' benefits are it's a social program, okay? It's not a welfare program. It's a social program because it helps those who are in need, those who have served their country. And when it comes to any social program, they clump all social programs under the same heading. You can go back, and if you will look at speeches by President Bush, you will find Medicare, Medicaid, and VA benefits all put into the same sentence and clustered together as the same type of program, an entitlement program that basically many in the president's party, the Republican Party, and this includes the former head of the House Committee on Veterans Affairs, Representative Steve Booyer from Indiana, they consider it a welfare program or a giveaway program. They're just not interested in putting money into any program that comes under the heading of a social program.
But they are putting money into the pockets of VA career executives.
Are they ever? They have a huge bonus program that and the bonus programs, the incentive programs that they have for the VA executives and the career executives cost them millions and millions of dollars a year. And what this is this is supposed to guarantee quality care and quality service for the veterans. This is something that has been complained about by veterans groups for years and years. You will see it in every government agency. The VA, once again last year, gave out the, on average, the highest dollar amount in bonuses, over $16,000 to their career executives.
Yeah, $16,713
yes.
Average for over 75% of their career executives.
But
nothing for the frontline people, nothing for the nurses, nothing for the docs, nothing for the physical therapists, nothing for the people who are running the facilities.
And those people are paid lower by far than the same, the people performing the same jobs out in the civilian healthcare community, Tom. It's
well,
a shame.
You know, it just sounds very Republican to me, Larry. What can I say? Larry Scott, I know you're nonpartisan, and I'm not going to drag you into that. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org is the website. Check it out. Larry, thanks for being with us.
Thank you again, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Cat Stevens now on the no-fly list for converting to Islam. Yes, it's true. I'm not making this up. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The World Bank has said no thanks to Paul Wolfowitz's attempt to insert right-wing ideology, right-wing religious ideology. And I think it's important to note this cuts across the board. Wolfowitz, I'm pretty sure, is Jewish, and this is generally associated with right-wing Christian ideology, but the whole idea that women should not have information about, and teenagers in particular should not have information about, sexual and reproductive health or rights. Here's the story. The Center for American Progress laying it out over at their blog thing, progress.org. The World Bank's executive board has approved a 10-year health, nutrition, and population strategy that strongly endorses sexual and reproductive health and rights, rejecting President Paul Wolfowitz's regressive draft version that made virtually no reference to sexual and reproductive health. So good on them. And is this the end of military blogs? The Army has now said to soldiers, you may no longer post to blogs, and you can't even send a personal email to your wife without consent from your superior officer. Seems that too many stories about what's going on in Iraq are getting out. Not a good thing in the minds of the Army. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Caleb in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Caleb, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning. What a great show you have.
Thank you.
You know, I was trying to think of a mnemonic because you had a terrific one for the congressional switchboard. And one I came up with was 202-BAKE-1-B-1. That's 202-BAKE-1, B-A-K-E-1-B, the letter B-1. And it works. Cut it multiple times. And also there's BALD-1-B-1, but I think BAKE-1-B-1. Yeah. And you're in there in the kitchen.
Bake digit one, letter B, digit one.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's 202-225-3121 is the
right.
that you're coming up with. Write that down, David. I'm talking to my producer here. Good one, Caleb.
Thank you, sir.
And thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. And thanks for listening on AM620 KPOJ here in Portland. JR in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, JR.
Hello, Tom. My comments about the mental health issue that you were discussing earlier, it's not necessarily just about the abused children, but in children in general, in their ability to interact with one another and in society, and what I think has actually caused problems with their development as far as fitting in and rebelling and stuff like that. At a young age, we're taught about the Easter Bunny, the Tooth Fairy, Santa Claus, and one after another, these idols fall. You know, you realize they're not real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You hear your dad in the car embellishing a story about, you know, something you were there to witness. You know, they tell you don't drink, don't smoke, but yet they do those things. And then in society, as you grow up to be a young woman and young man, you realize that people are acting in every aspect of life. I mean, essentially, the marketers sell costumes so people can pretend to be something that they're not. And it causes this scenario where you're like, well, who do I pretend to be?
There's a certain amount of dissonance in there. Yeah, JR, I don't disagree with you about dissonance and the loss of innocence, I suppose you could call it. I'd say, however, that even larger than that, if you want to look at the cultural variables that are crashing our culture, particularly for our young people right now and failing our young people, the two big ones on my radar screen are, number one, the destruction of the economic middle class in the United States, parents increasingly being frantic about, you know, just making a living from day to day and living in fear of what's going to happen if they get sick. Are they going to lose their health benefits? Are they, if they lose their job, will they, you know, that kind of thing, number one. And number two, the crushing power of a consumeristic society that's driven in large part by television and that promotes the value that you are the most important person in the world, which is the core message of most consumeristic driven advertising, that is, you know, promoting products that people don't really need. And I realize that puts me at a certain level at odds with commercial radio, and I'm sure 100 people will point that out. Thus, I will say so to begin with. And, you know, there are a lot of products out there that we do need or can use, but targeting children in particular for bizarre role models, you know, the whole let's market, you know, Paris Hilton to 10-year-olds, that kind of thing. I have a real problem with it. I think that there need to be some reasonable limits. Beverly in Pittsburgh. Hey, Beverly.
Yes, sir. Well, it's too late now. They vetoed. They can't override the veto. My idea was to have more and more earmarks and make it legitimate. And then
they can resubmit the bill, you know.
What?
They can resubmit the bill.
Redo the bill?
Yeah, all they have to do is just hold another vote in the House and another vote in the Senate for the exact same piece of legislation and see if they pick up a couple more Republicans, and then he'll veto it again, and then a month from now they can do it again.
Well, as a historian, I wanted to ask you, what advice would you give us when we call the congressional offices? What can we advise them besides more and more earmarks, as they call them?
Yeah. Necessary. Well, I think John Edwards' suggestion, Beverly, uh-huh. and thank you for the question. I think John Edwards' suggestion is a good one, that Congress, the House and the Senate, should bring the exact same legislation up to a vote again and pass it and see how many more Republicans they're going to get on board. And every few weeks, every time Bush vetoes it, bring it up again and pass it until you have enough Republicans in the Senate. What they basically need is, what, another 10, 12, Senate, 12 Republicans, I think 13 Republicans, whatever it is. They need a few more Republican votes in the Senate to make this thing veto-proof. And that's the end of it. I mean, that's all they need to do. And step one. John in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, John.
Hi. I generally agree with your analysis of the way cheap immigrant labor is hurting the prospects for creating a middle class in this country. But what I might quibble a little bit with you about is labeling any kind of guest worker program as destructive to the middle class and immediately comparing it to the discredited Bracero program, which, of course, is famously depicted by Woody Guthrie in the song Deportee. And yep. The reason I say that is because here in the Northwest, there's long been a tradition of people who, with relatively low skills going up to Alaska, excuse me, and working for 4 or 5 months and coming back and living off the proceeds for the rest of the year. And, you know, we never felt, you know, the white Anglos who did this never felt exploited. And I'm just wondering why we have to label all guest worker programs like that as being out of bounds.
Well, that's not a guest worker program. If an American moves from one state to another to get a job and take advantage of an economic opportunity, that's not a guest worker program. That's, you know, Alaska's part of the United States. The guest worker program that the Bush administration and, frankly, the Democrats are proposing, in my opinion, is a reinvention of the Bracero program. I realize that it's not called that. It's not that totally intact. But and certainly the one that the Wall Street Journal is calling for in their editorial today, in my opinion, is a reinvention of the Bracero program. And I think it's a terrible thing. I think it's a terrible thing for the people who would be participating in it. Many of them would be the first to tell you that people can be fired. And by being fired, they immediately get deported. And that's, you know, so the employer, what it does is it places much, much more power in the hands of the employers. And that's just, you know, the whole point of trying to build a middle class with organized labor is to equalize power. That was what the Wagner Act was all about. Unionization is equalizing power in the workplace, bringing democracy into the workplace. Ron in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Ron.
Hi, Tom. You have a great show. I wanted to just tell you a little story about the VA and what is happening to this organization with the cuts that are, being put through by Bush. I have a man who works for me, 60 years old, Vietnam vet, partially disabled, liver problems that have been acknowledged for years. And this man has sworn up and down how great the VA has been as it's treated him over the years. He came to me in November, had been diagnosed with liver cancer. And I, you know, I gave him some moral support, and I said, I hope you, you know, what are you going to do, and we'll do, you know, give you time off, what do you need? This was in November. It was mid-February before the VA finally got him scheduled for a chemotherapy session. And he went in, and he called me on the phone that afternoon. He was about crying. They said, well, we don't have any beds available, and so we're going to have to reschedule you. And then they said, well, really, we have empty beds, but we might have an emergency, and this chemotherapy is considered an elective procedure. And if you come back in 6 weeks, it may be, you know, we can't guarantee that we'll have a bed for you then. He ended up going to, you know, he's now going to the University of New Mexico Hospital, and they're trying to treat it, whether they, you know, cancer isn't something you wait 4 or 5 months to deal with, especially in the liver. So I don't know what's going to happen with him, but it's just devastated him how he's been treated. And I think it's, he says the intent of the people are good, but it's just the cutbacks.
Well, this war is, it's not just the cutbacks in the Bush administration, it's also the war. It's putting an incredible strain on the entire system.
And it's not just, not the poor individuals who are coming back from Iraq, but you have all of these other people who, from Vietnam or from whatever else, that need care for Vietnam, and every one of them is being impacted too.
Yep, spot on. You know, well said, Ron. And all the more reason when you're talking to your elected officials to say, hey, let's fully fund the VA. Or let's get a full national health care program where every American has full health insurance, period. 45 minutes past due.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Dreaming of democracy here, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman with you. And time now for a Jaws alert. This from Reuters. The Arctic ice cap is melting much faster than expected and is now about 30 years ahead of predictions made by the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. A U.S. ice expert said on Tuesday, you will remember, by the way, the IPCC is the group that all the global warming deniers say was being hysterical. Well, the actual melt is 30 years ahead of what the IPCC had predicted. This means the ocean at the top of the world could be free or nearly free of summer ice by 2020, 3 decades sooner than what had been predicted. No ice in the Arctic Ocean during summer would be a major spur to global warming, said Ted Scambos, a glaciologist at the National Snow and Ice Center in Colorado. Right now, he said, the Arctic helps keep the Earth cool. Without that Arctic ice, or with less of it, the Earth will warm much faster. That's because the ice reflects heat and light. When it's gone, the much darker land or sea will absorb more light and heat, making it more difficult for the planet to cool down even in winter. Not good news. We can do something about it by rolling back the carbon that we have and beginning to sequester the carbon that's in the air, and that we do that through, frankly, through governmental processes. And, you know, contacting your members of Congress and saying, hey, let's do something about global warming. Catherine in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to say thank you. You're doing such a great job. And so are your listeners. They're just, you know, they're all just, seems like everybody's pulling together. It feels really good.
I
just want to, you know, you had said something about we need a few more Republicans on our side. My question is, who would that be so I would know who to call, who to leave messages to make them feel extremely guilty and that they should be on our side, you know?
Well, the best advice, I think, is to call the Republicans who represent you. And I know that being in Michigan, you're represented in the Senate by two Democrats, by Carl Levin and Debbie Stabenow, who are both, you know, very, very good Democrats and doing a great job in the Senate. Carl Levin is an institution. I mean, he was, I think he was in the Senate back when I lived in, you know, I grew up in Michigan and I left in 78. And he was doing something in politics back then, I remember. But in any case, because you have two Democrats, then, you know, it becomes a little more problematic. Because increasingly what's happening is members of Congress are ignoring calls or emails, or by and large, they're all ignoring emails now. And they're ignoring calls and they're ignoring letters that come from outside their district. They're just writing it off as pressure groups and things like that.
Oh.
So the thing to do is to talk to your friends who are of like mind, who live in states that are represented by Republican senators. You know, for example, here I am in Oregon. I have a Republican Senator, Gordon Smith. If you know somebody who lives in a state that has a Republican senator, ask them to call their senator and give them the phone number. Tell them, hey, it's 202-225-3121. And there's a variety of toll-free numbers as well that you can easily Google. And usually we have on our website, you can track them down. Although they change all the time. Call the Republican members of Congress and say, get on board with us. And the other thing I'd do right now, as a person from Michigan, if I were in your situation, Catherine, is I would call Debbie Stabenow and Carl Levin and say, please, you know, work to end this war as quickly as possible. And please, would you put as much pressure as possible on your Republican colleagues? Because frankly, Debbie Stabenow and Carl Levin having lunch with a Republican in the Senate office building is also going to have some impact. And if they're hearing from a lot of their constituents that they need to be speaking out more loudly, then I think that you know, that's a good start. So
okay.
You know, I hope that's a beginning, Kate. But thanks. Sorry about that. Thanks so much for the call, and much appreciated. 1-866-303-2270. Michael in L.A. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, I hope that Congress would tell Republicans in the House that, you know, this is it. This is the bill. And here we have a president, a lame duck, with a 33% approval rating, defying the constitutional will and authority of Congress, doing so with deception, distortions, belligerence, wanting to put...
Well, he does have the constitutional right to veto a bill.
They have a constitutional authorization and obligation to exercise their will, too, and they can do so by saying, there's the bill that's on your desk, or you Republicans in the House want to support the override, that's fine, but that's their only obligation. They're not obligated to capitulate to a horrible wordsmithing and distortions of what the bill
absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Michael. And that's why I say they should simply resubmit this thing.
Yeah, and or just leave it on his desk. You sign it when you want.
Well, it's already been vetoed. They have to resubmit it, so he has to re-veto it.
Absolutely, but to do anything else, to surge over to the White House to talk, he's the one who wants to play this war of nerves game.
Yeah, and if he wants to play that game, I think that they should just say, okay, we're going to take another vote. Let's see how many Republicans want to vote for this time. Ralph in Colorado Springs, a little less than a minute here before we've got to wrap up this hour, Ralph. What's up?
Yeah, I just heard Bush say, either we succeed or we don't. I mean, is he starting
to
in the war?
I think it was a rhetorical faux pas. You know, I don't think that he really meant that, where he's, I realize it's the headline over at Huffington Post right now and in a lot of newspapers. And, you know, it's like his...
If it feels good, do it.
You know, it's that kind of stuff. You know, Bush just, he's got foot and mouth disease. And so, although maybe some reality is starting to dawn, see, as long as he's accepting the frame that it's a war and it will be lost or won, then the idea that it might be resolved politically will seem to him like a loss. And so as people come to him and they say, well, Mr. President, really, it's not a war, it's an occupation, and occupations are resolved politically in all cases. You don't win an occupation. You eventually leave from an occupation, ideally. So I think he's starting to get it, but he's trying to fit it into that frame of war that he's so wed to, and he doesn't quite know how to do it. And so his language is getting sloppy. Tomorrow, Michael Cannon, conservative, is going to be with us talking about whether or not we should set prices for docs. It's really about Medicare. Andrew Gause is going to be with us asking why are America's ports, airports, and toll roads on the auction block. And never forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.